Thank you. I was just reflecting on some of those songs during the worship time, and I was just thinking of how beautiful the words are. And I don't know about you, but sometimes I sort of look at worship songs in a non-worship context and like to pull them apart a bit to make sure they're theologically correct. And I was looking at some of these songs, especially Sweetly Broken, and it just breaks my heart every time. It's such a beautiful, beautiful song. So if none of this makes sense to you, go home and read that song, because it is a great song. I wanted to start with a bit of a question and to just to reflect upon, have you ever been in a really, really hopeless situation, an utterly, utterly hopeless situation where everything is just a dead end? Any solution actually is just another facet of the problem. It's a bit of a depressing start, really. But I think a lot of us have been in that place, and I'm fairly convinced there's not really anybody here who hasn't been or hasn't had that experience and hasn't been in that place. Even as little children, we can feel helpless and hopeless in situations. And as adults, sometimes that intensifies, where we just feel that things are a little bit out of our control and we just can't work out where to go next. And there are some things that join us together as people. And I think that one of them is suffering. And it does. It brings us together. It's a communal experience. And I think another thing that joins us together is our questioning of that suffering, of its purpose, of its existence, of its significance. A few weeks ago, Kate talked about walking with God through the hard times, and she encouraged us to stand with each other in our questioning. And it made me question, and I went home and I reflected on some times I felt very helpless and actually quite hopeless. When my middle daughter Emily was born, it was such a relief, partly because I wanted pregnancy to end, but also because I developed quite a rare condition during my pregnancy, which the doctor very calmly told me could result in either her death or mine or both. And it was utterly terrifying. And I remember I sort of sat there and went, oh, right, what do we do then? And the doctor said, well, you have to have your baby. Have you got your diary? So in a very Victoria Beckham fashion, I got out my diary and flicked it and went, I'm free next Tuesday. And the doctor said, yes, that's fine. So it was actually quite a relief when she was born, and I had her early, and she was born, and she was well, and she was strong. And 4 weeks later, she was born on the 18th of December, so 4 weeks later, I was having some dinner with Alex and Lucy Holt. They came round for dinner, and Emily had been a bit poorly. She'd had a bit of a cold, a bit snuffly, been a bit off her milk, and it wasn't particularly good. And so we kept her downstairs in her crib, just so, you know, we could keep a bit of an eye on her. And at about 10 o'clock, Alex went over to her little crib, and he picked her up, and he went, she's a bit blue. And we went, oh, and she really was. She wasn't just a little tinge blue, she was blue, blue. And Lucy suggested that perhaps we ought to ring a doctor, because at that point I just sort of shut down and didn't really know what to do. So we rang a doctor, who suggested to send an ambulance. Nick and I, in our wisdom, decided, don't worry, we'll drive. And we drove to the hospital. And when we got there, we were told, one more minute and you would have lost her. And that was terrifying. It stopped me in my tracks. It began a time of what seemed like a very hopeless situation. We rushed her to the hospital. We put her down on a bed. A woman picked her up. She ran with her. Her heart stopped beating. She stopped breathing. And everything became very, very bleak. And I remember that I stood there almost, it was almost an out-of-body experience. I sort of stood there looking at them working on her. And this weird nurse who kept offering me a cup of tea and holding my hand, I just said yes to make her go away in the end. And I never actually got that cup of tea, can I point out. But she went and did that, and I remember looking, and it all was just like a bubble, like an absolute bubble. And I clung to Nick, and we begged God to save her. My mum says that when she came to the hospital, she walked past this elderly, stooped couple in the corridor and stopped and realised it was us, because we were like this. But she made it through that hour, and then she made it through the second hour and the third hour, and then she got to intensive care. For a lot of people, that's the worst place in the world. For me, that was great. She'd made it that far. And she was in this little box, little oxygen box, and this nurse looking at her like this, and every time she did that, she wrote it down. And then, as every mother will think is brilliant, a bottle of Calpol at the end of the bed, because Calpol, as we know, saves everything. And she spent time in intensive care, and eventually she got better. Well, a little bit. And I clearly remember praying, oh God, will you save her? I bargained with him. I begged him. I got so angry with him. And then I just sat, because I had nothing else to feel. And some people said to me, you've got to have hope and you've got to have faith. And me being me, the little questioner that I am, sat there and went, well, faith for what? Faith that God will give me what I want. Or, in fact, faith that God is who he says he is. And even if I don't get my desire, his word and his character are still true. And I remember saying to God at some point, please save her. But even if she dies, I know that you are good and you are just, and I hope I have it in me to still worship you. What a weird thing to say. It's a really peculiar thing to say. How can God be good and just in the instance of perhaps my baby dying? And I wrestled with that question again and again, but I had to come to God and say, I have to look to you, not to the situation, and to your character, not to the mess I'm in. Now, I teach A-level philosophy, which is always fun, and we spend a huge amount of our course examining this question on why do bad things happen to good people? Why does a God who is good and just let sad things happen? And I was thinking, well, why? Why? Why in a secular exam is that such a massive question? And my response to that is because it's a real question asked by real people every day. And it's just a very normal question, I think, that people perhaps can ask. And we shouldn't be scared to ask it. I'm not saying, though, that I actually have a clear-cut answer. Many of my friends and family are struggling with this issue. Why is there pain? Why does God say in his word that he'll protect me and then I get ill? And there are many theological and philosophical teachings on it. And some of them I find comfort in. Some of them work to my rational understanding in my head. Others I find ridiculously unhelpful. I remember when I married Nick, and some of you will remember this, even before I married him, Nick, my husband, had a really, really, really bad back. In fact, it was terribly bad, and he would pass out frequently from pain, to the point where when he lived in a lad's house at the other end of the street from me, and when we got married, we would have to place cushions at the bottom of the stairs, because he would tumble down the stairs, because he'd black out at the top, and we would just pick him up at the bottom and dust him down and carry on again. And this would happen quite frequently. It was a bit frightening, actually. And we prayed and we asked God to heal him. Over the years of praying and fasting and praying again, and we heard many, many theories as to why God allowed Nick to suffer. The least helpful was when people would say to us that all his pain was caused by unconfessed sin. But Nick and I, being very, very dutiful people, sat down and Nick confessed and repented of everything he could think of, and even a few things he hadn't even done, to be on the safe side, just to make sure there was nothing left. Yet his back was still bad. It wasn't particularly helpful. Another unhelpful response for me was that Nick clearly lacked faith that God would change his circumstance, and that's why he was still in that place. But this didn't ring completely true for me, because I knew of many faithful people who had endured great suffering, and God hadn't healed them either. I'm not saying that unconfessed sin and lack of faith are irrelevant in our suffering. Sometimes maybe they are, but only that it's not a complete explanation, and I don't think it should be offered as such. Because it was quite damaging for us, because we were quite young and didn't really understand. So I thought, well, I don't really know what's going on. What should I do? So I decided to read the Bible. And I got to the first three chapters of Genesis and went, it's a bit hard, isn't it, starting at the beginning. But as I looked over the Bible, I realized that this idea of suffering is a theme that goes right the way through. From the very first book to the very last book of the Bible, there is this theme of suffering and God walking with his people through it. And I just was quite astounded by that one day. And I thought, the Bible doesn't ignore suffering. It's not telling me that I should just be triumphant over it and pretend it's not happening. What it's saying is God doesn't ignore my suffering. In fact, the Bible points to God in my suffering. And for me, that was a big turnaround. Now, that might be obvious to some of you, but to me, that was a big thing. And I was like, just sat there and thought, I've got to look to God because he knows suffering more than I do because he's written an enormous book about it. So he knows what he's talking about. And there's a Bible verse that I was going to read to you that I really like. It's from Psalm 61, verse 2. It's the second little bit of it. It says, I call as my heart grows faint. Lead me to the rock that is higher than I. And I find quite a lot of reassurance in that, that I get faint sometimes, but lead me to the rock that is higher than I. Lead me to God. There's another verse in the book of Habakkuk, which I love saying that, because when you say it at school, the children don't believe me when I say it's actually a book in the Bible. They go, Habakkuk, and they're like, you're having a laugh. That's not real, you made that up. And then when I say Obadiah, that's even more funny. They just don't believe me that these things are real. But in Habakkuk 3, 17 to 18, it says, though the fig tree does not bud, and there are no grapes on the vines, though the olive crop fails, and the fields produce no food, though there are no sheep in the sheepfold, no cattle in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will be joyful in God, my Saviour. So when the Bible talks about suffering, it seems to have a different perspective to me. I tend to look at the suffering, and the Bible tends to look to God. You see, I understand the idea of a God who wants to have a relationship with us, a relationship that's not coerced, it's not forced, and it's not robotic, one that's based on genuine freedom. I love that idea of genuine freedom. I'm genuinely free. I'm free to choose to love God or to not. And that also means I'm free to choose my actions. And at times people get hurt by them. I wish I could stand here and say I've never caused hurt in other people's lives, but it would be a lie. I have, through my choice and through my actions. A fantastic book that explores the idea of this free will and the problems that it causes for people is The Shack by William Young. And if you've never read this book, this is what it looks like. If you've never read it, I just encourage you just to read this book because it explores this story, this idea of our relationship with God and the consequences of that as a beautiful narrative. It's about a man's heartache after the kidnap and murder of his child and how he wrestles with God through that situation. And it is a fantastic exploration of where is God in your suffering. You see, we live in a broken world that brings hurt and harm to people, either at the hands of humanity or at the hands of nature. In this book, sorry, I'm a bit of a book person, this book, Reason for God by Tim Keller, he's a New York pastor and he explains the problem of suffering in a bit of a perspective in here. And I'd really recommend this book as a great read. If you wrestle with these sorts of ideas, have a look through it. And he finishes chapter 2 with a fantastic quote from C.S. Lewis, the man who wrote the Narnia stories. And C.S. Lewis said, they say of some temporal suffering, no future bliss can make up for it, not knowing that heaven, once attained, will work backwards and turn even that agony into a glory. Now, my Emily did get better. And looking back on that time, I can see a God at work in so many ways. I got to chat to a dad in intensive care whose child would never leave, about a God who loved him and cried with him. Our Christian friend was a consultant on the ward, and that was just brilliant because he came and prayed with us, and he prayed for Emily. And lots of friends and families and people from church came, and they sat and they prayed, or they just sat. And it was great when people didn't try to answer my why question. They just sat and let me just work this one out with God. And I learned a lot about having to have faith at the time. Now, I asked Emily for permission to tell this story this morning, as it is her story. And she was ridiculously excited because she gets to be famous for the morning. She was so excited. But it's also because, weirdly, this quite frightening experience in her life, which she, I don't know if she fully remembers, but it has become almost a gift of faith for her. A few weeks ago, she had to take a box about herself into school, a shoebox, and she had to put things in it about her. And she has kept and put in it her inhaler, because it's part of her life. She had to take in baby photos, and all the other kids took these really cute baby photos in. Emily took the one of her in an oxygen box with tubes going up her nose. The teacher said it was a bit frightening. But apparently she stood and said to her class, this is me when I was ill, and God made me better. It's an incredible gift of faith for such a little girl to have. And I think that the agony, like C.S. Lewis says, will be a glory for her in this life. But for some, suffering endures beyond their mortal life. And I think maybe even God can work through that. I'm not trying to say that every time we go through suffering, we should go, oh, well, it'll all work out all right in the end. God will do something with it. Because I don't want to devalue or diminish the hurt that we feel when we go through a tough time. But there is a hope for us that there is something beyond this life that can turn this journey into something glorious. I mentioned this to my mum the other day, and she said, yes, your dad died before you were born, and now look at you. I was like, whoa, what a great thing to say. Something that could have been a tragedy actually has worked out quite well. That sounds a bit odd, but you get my meaning there. I taught a lesson at school a while ago on forgiveness, and we looked at the testimony of a woman called G. Walker. I quite like her because her name is G. Walker, and that's my name, so I quite like her. And her teenage son was murdered by people he had known since primary school. And she publicly forgave her son's killers on TV, and the media went bonkers. They were astounded by this woman. She spoke of God's love and mercy towards the killers. She spoke of her son in heaven with Jesus. And I remember as a class, we just sat there and went, oh, at the end. And there was just this silence in my classroom when they listened to this woman tell her story. And then this girl put her hand up and she said, she looks really peaceful. I was like, she really did. Really, really did. See, I had hope for my little Emily to live, and I had hope that God would save her mortal life. But I had to recognize that even if he didn't, my faith in his goodness went beyond this mortal life to a future glory with him. If Emily didn't make it, she would be with Jesus. It makes it sound, doesn't it, as though I came to that place in a matter of moments. I really didn't. It was quite a long journey. It took a lot of time to process what had happened, what nearly happened, where was God in it all. And I sometimes get asked, would I have come to the same conclusion if she had died? And I'd like to think, yes, maybe I would. But I think it probably would have taken a lot longer to get there, if I'm honest. Having faith that God's promises were true beyond my mortal time span was quite a journey to go on. And it was during this time that I found myself reading the Bible quite a lot. I would love to share with you a story that spoke to me at the time, and it's a story tucked away in Matthew's Gospel. And Matthew's Gospel is a beautiful story of the life of Jesus. And it's written about 75 to 85 AD, not entirely pinpointing a date there, about 50 years-ish after the death and resurrection of Jesus. It's very likely that Matthew, as an author, had read Mark's Gospel, but also that he had another source of information as well, just to help him bring together all these stories. And for a long time, people thought that maybe the author of Matthew's Gospel was the apostle, the disciple, the tax collector. But we're not completely certain about that, to be honest, because had he been, he wouldn't have really needed to use as much of Mark's Gospel to help him write his, because, to be honest, he was there himself and would have already known it. So it's quite likely that he was a later follower of Jesus. So authorship is a little bit of a mystery, but it's a very reliable gospel because you will find the stories in it in all the other gospels as well. Now, all the gospel writers have an intention behind their writing, and Matthew wrote to show the Jewish people of the time and those who would read his gospel later that Jesus was that long-promised Messiah. He was the one they were waiting for, the Son of God. God had sent his Messiah. He was faithful to his promises. He was faithful to his people. So that's what Matthew was trying to show. It also has lots of instruction in it, lots of stories about how to live your life. And it's within this big picture of the gospel, the idea that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, everything that was promised, that we find the story of Jesus walking on water, which David mentioned a bit this morning. And it's in Matthew chapter 14, verse 22 to 36. Now, if you want to read it for yourself, Matthew's gospel is the first book of the New Testament, about two-thirds of the way through, after Malachi and before Mark. And the words will appear on the screen, but if you want to grab a Bible from around, if you don't have one, feel free to grab one. If you don't own it, feel free to take it, because I have the budget for buying new ones and I'm fine with that. Just take it home. Okay, let's find out where we are. Verse 22. Immediately, Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to the other side, while he dismissed the crowd. After he had dismissed them, he went up on a mountainside by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone. But the boat was already a considerable distance from the land, buffeted by the waves because the wind was against it. Shortly before dawn, Jesus went out to them, walking on the lake. When the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. "It's a ghost," they said, and cried out in fear. But Jesus immediately said to them, "Take courage, it is I, do not be afraid." "Lord, if it's you," Peter replied, "tell me to come to you on the water." "Come," he said. Then Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, and came towards Jesus. And when he saw the wind, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, cried out, "Lord, save me." Immediately Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. "You have little faith," he said, "why did you doubt?" And when they climbed into the boat, the wind died down. Then those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, "Truly you are the Son of God." I think it stops there. No, it carries on. When they had crossed over, they landed in Gennesaret. And when the men of that place recognized Jesus, they sent word to all the surrounding country. People brought all who were ill to him and begged him to let those who were ill just touch the edge of his cloak, and all who touched him were healed. The first passage, the first word of that story is really important, immediately. It's such an important thing. And for me, when I read the word immediately at the start of a passage, it says, find out what's just happened. Because something very important has just happened if it starts with an immediately. So looking back, two major events have just happened in the life of Jesus. First of all, the death of his cousin, John the Baptist. John baptized Jesus at the start of his ministry. He was a trusted friend and probably a childhood companion. They'd known each other since they were younger. In other Gospels, it mentions him as well. And Jesus sought a bit of solitude, a place to go and grieve. But he couldn't do it because large crowds followed him. And then from a place of grief, Jesus teaches 5,000 men, women weren't counted, 5,000 men, and feeds them with 5 loaves and 2 fishes. And a great miracle that's retold for over 2,000 years. So, you know, they've just seen Jesus do some pretty amazing stuff there. So from this place, you know, of grief and probably being very exhausted, he sent his disciples to the other side of the lake, and he wanted some time with God the Father on his own. And the disciples are having a bit of a rough journey. The wind is high and they're being thrown all around the place. And then just before dawn, they see Jesus walking towards them. And they're terrified because they think he's a ghost. Well, to be fair, so would I. I'd be absolutely terrified. Everything I knew would just go out the window at that point. It's a really understandable reaction. You don't expect to see people on walking on water towards you. You know, it's just not entirely normal. However, they had just seen him miraculously feed 5,000 people, earlier on raise a girl from the dead, earlier on heal a bleeding woman who'd been bleeding for endless years, and free many people from evil spirits. So it wasn't like they weren't used to Jesus doing some particularly odd stuff. There were many miracles, but back in their normal everyday world, they returned to fear and unknowing, because that's what they were used to. It was their own environment. In verse 27, it says, "But Jesus immediately says to them, 'Take courage, it is I, don't be afraid.'" And I love the word immediately here again. Jesus is there as soon as he is needed. He instructs them to have courage, and his presence and person is enough. Nothing else is required. Interestingly, the Greek, I have to get that in somewhere, the Greek of the I am is ego imai, and it means just I am. The same word that God spoke to Moses through the burning bush. Just I am. And it's connecting Jesus to God. And the Jewish people at the time would open their eyes at that and go, "Ooh, who is this? Who can say such things?" You know, that's a big phrase to just come out with and say. Jesus is God. That's why his presence gives us cause to take courage and in turn not to be afraid. And after hearing this, Peter should be all fired up, full of faith, ready to go. Yet he asks in verse 28, "Lord, if it's you," if. He's got quite a lot of clues going on here, but he's, "If it's you, tell me to come to you on the water." He's willing to take a risk, but he needs to know that Jesus is who he says he is. He needs to know, not just up here, but in here. He's hopeful in the person of Jesus. He's hopeful he's not just some ordinary bloke. There's a bit more to him. Yet he still has a moment of doubt. He seeks direction from Jesus. He takes his step. He has faith at that point that Jesus is the Messiah. I don't think that Peter's faith is that he can walk on water. I don't think that's what he had faith for. I'm not convinced that's the life skill he's after. I don't think he's trying to develop a walking on water ministry and that he's thinking, "I'm just going to go out in faith and learn how to walk on water and that's me done, tick, for the rest of my life. I will be the man who walks on water." I don't think that's the skill he's after. I think his belief is that Jesus is the real thing, is what he's after. That's the faith bit. Is Jesus that real thing? I'm absolutely convinced also that he didn't want to drown. Okay, I think anybody in that situation would not want to drown in the waves and all of that. And so the ability to walk on water is quite necessary. So, you know, that's I do need that if I'm going to take this step. However, his faith and hope is in the person of Jesus and not that physical world all around him. So he walks towards Jesus, and then there's this tiny little word at the beginning of verse 30. But. Just but. And it's a turning point in his life and in this story. He is suddenly acutely aware of his circumstances. He's a fisherman. He knows how rough the sea gets. He knows how dangerous it can be. And his conviction that Jesus is who he says he is begins to lessen in the face of his actually quite realistic knowledge of how bad worldly things can get. It all gets a bit too much. He begins to sink. To be honest, that's how I felt in the hospital when Emily was so ill. My world just was sinking all around me. And there was this dawning realization that the world was a broken place and people die. And I began to sink. And I stretched out my hand, and Jesus got me through those weeks, those months. And I don't mean got me through because he healed her and she got better. I mean got me through because he did something to my soul that wasn't there before, that gave me a bit of a resilience that just made me keep going. I don't know about you, but I've often heard people criticise Peter for sinking. But I've always been really impressed by two things. Firstly, he got out of the boat. I think I would have stayed in it. I was going, well, I'm staying here. He got out of the boat. And secondly, in his moment of fear, in that moment of overwhelming hopelessness, in that moment of a dawning realisation of his physical circumstances, his instant response was to call out in faith to the person who he knew could and would save him. Straight away, look to Jesus, get me out of this. He didn't just keep sinking and sinking until he was under the waves and then swam back to the boat. He didn't try to swim, he just reached out his hand and said, get me. And Jesus did. That other little word that keeps cropping up in relation to Jesus, immediately, three times in one passage. Jesus is there, stretching out his hand, saving him. And then Jesus asked Peter why he doubted, which I find interesting, because he didn't ask him why he was frightened. I always find that really interesting. I always assume Jesus would go, why are you so frightened? But he didn't. Because I think he understood that this is actually quite a frightening place we're in sometimes. It is frightening. Let's be real about it. It is. But he said, why did you doubt? And it's an interesting question because I suspect Jesus actually already knew the answer. I think Peter doubted because it all became too much. And he realised sort of the stupidity of what he was attempting to do. His faith in the person of Jesus faltered a bit. He felt consumed by the world again. He called out in hope that Jesus would be there to save him. I guess we all find ourselves at times attempting to walk on water a bit. We're full of hope and conviction, and then something happens and we might lose that hope and conviction that we're doing the right thing. Perhaps someone questions our actions. Or we realise that our dreams and hopes from God are a bit strange to other people, and they look at us quizzically and we can feel ourselves sort of going, oh, sinking a bit inside. Maybe our lives are going really well, and then something happens. We get hurt, betrayed. We end up in debt, we lose our job, our spouse becomes a stranger, loved ones die and the innocent suffer. And I cannot explain the why of all of these things. Yet I know they are a reality. We live in a world of broken people, but we live in a world of people who need hope. When I feel overwhelmed by circumstance, I have to stretch out my hand to the person of Jesus, who is just and who is good, and goes beyond my mortal time span into eternity. The man Jesus, the man who grieved for his cousin, he knows our suffering, even to the point of his own death. We can reach out to him, because he's not a God who is indifferent to our suffering. He's not a God who says, well, better luck next time. He's not a God who says, well, you should have behaved yourself, then it wouldn't happen. He's a God who says, I know. My circumstances may change. They may not. God might heal, he might not. Yet the person of Jesus will steady my soul for the journey and he will walk with me back to the boat. And I love that idea. He will take my hand and he will walk with me where I'm going. And he will steady my soul for the journey ahead. So what of the other disciples, the ones in the boat? That would still be me, the people in the boat. As much as I've heard Peter criticised for sinking, I've heard the other disciples criticised for not getting out of the boat at all. Maybe they were too scared to try. Maybe they often left things to Peter. He was one of Jesus' closest friends. He was a leader amongst them. Maybe they were kicking him out and saying, "You go. If you don't sink, we'll follow." Who knows why they were there? Maybe they lacked conviction that Jesus was who he said he was. Maybe they didn't understand that everybody gets to play. They were all able to take risks for Jesus. They were all being called to follow in his footsteps. They were all allowed to see what he was doing and follow him. But when Jesus got in the boat, verse 32 says, they worshipped him. They recognized him for who he was, and then they put their faith in him. They were still in the boat, though, at this point, still had to get to the other side. But they worshipped him and they knew who he was. It can be hard to do that, I think, when we have so many questions. But our God is not a God who ignores our suffering or a God who judges our questions. I learned that at a very early age from my mum when she used to say, it's okay to ask, just don't always expect an answer. And that's not because God isn't answering. She said, it's just sometimes you won't understand. And I sat there and I thought, sometimes I'm not going to understand. I'm just me. I'm not going to understand why things happen the way they do. But I know that I have a God who loves me and he will walk with me back to my boat. He is a God who is so involved in our suffering that he himself suffered and died so that we could be with him for all eternity. So things might not turn out the way we want them to, and I don't say that glibly. But God is constant and unchanging and he loves us. And I wanted to finish with a small verse from the New Testament in the book of Romans. And it says, Romans 15:13, may the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace as you trust in him, so that you may overflow with hope by the power of the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Let's pray for the hope. Come, Holy Spirit. Come with your good gifts. Come with hope. I pray for those people who are hopeless or their hope is weak. I ask you to come to them now and call to them like Peter, poor Jesus did to Peter. Call to them. Call to them. Evoke hope in them. Call to them. Give them a vision of who you are and your power and your strength and your love and your grace. May hope arise again, I pray.